You're very welcome along to this bonus episode of Tech Talk. Today, I'm sitting down with Gar McCriesta, the product manager for the COVID Tracker app at the HSE, for an exclusive in-depth conversation. We're going to talk through everything from the conception of the idea and the reliability of Bluetooth to data protection considerations and that awful Android battery drain issue. Plus, he explains what notifications you need to pay attention to. I would love to hear your thoughts and questions. You'll get me on Twitter at JessKellyNT, or you can email techtalk@newstalk.com. So here we go. This is my chat with Gar McCriesta, the product manager for the COVID Tracker app at the HSE. So, Gar, this is an interesting sort of one-of-a-kind type project that the HSE worked on with a number of different bodies, and it has been a success to date. You might just take us back to when this first was mentioned and the context in which it was first discussed.
So for me, this started on the 18th of March, but it originally started on St. Patrick's Day. With a conversation between Angartha Síochána, it was Department of Health, HSE, and Department of Public Expenditure. And it was generally trying to figure out how do we use technology and apply technology to help with contact tracing. So at that point in time, the HSE had stood up. Testing and tracing was in its infancy. We were standing up the testing centres around the country. The contact tracing centres were being set up. And this was an augmentation of that. So how do we use these things? And that began with a more or less a scramble to try and figure out what can we use? Because basically you're trying to solve, it ultimately boils down to a problem of trying to find people who are too close for too long. And how do we identify those people? And then how do we let them know if they've been in contact with somebody who's tested positive for COVID-19? So that, and you can do that in many different ways. So at the very beginning, like right now, as we look back at it, it all makes perfect sense that we would end up with a Bluetooth-based proximity detecting app that's privacy preserving. But back at that point in time, we were looking at using like what data could we use that would tell us who was where? And that could be GPS data, it could be telco data, it could be social media data, it could be things like ad identifier data is being used in different countries like that. So we were scouring the globe to try and figure out what other people were doing. And initially this started off as us using, so I think we built, like in the 100 days we spent building the app, I think we built it three times. So the first iteration was we were building it using basically using GPS data. So we're using GPS data and time to try and figure out were people in the same place at the same time. But there's a number of issues with that. I think that version of it lasted about 4 days. And then we moved. So, and it was via conversations with colleagues in the NHS in the UK and also in Singapore. Trace Together was released on the 21st of March. And Trace Together was the first of its kind. So basically the app we have today is derivative of that. And I think every other app globally is derivative of what they did at Trace Together. Some significant differences, but it all kind of comes from that. And it was using the Bluetooth sensor or the Bluetooth radio on your phone to send a signal and receive a signal and then figure out based on the strength of that signal, how far the phones were away from each other. And then for how long did those contacts occur? And that's basically what we have today. So that was kind of the origins of it. Mm. And those streams of activity lasted for, I think we were probably working in parallel on a number of them for probably the guts of a month as we began to kind of work to try and figure out, because we weren't guaranteed that we were going to hit to find the right answer. So we needed to keep our options open at that point.
Yeah, because I remember a few times I was one of the people who was going on with Ivan on the Hard Shoulder and so on, going, look, we've been promised it, but there's no sign of it. And people were understandably frustrated and were eager to get it. But it's clear that it wasn't as clean cut as the finished product that we have now just landed in your lap.
Yeah, it wasn't. And I think, so if you go back to the very beginning of this, so this is the bit prior to Google and Apple entering and kind of jumping onto the field. At that point in time, we were all trying to solve this problem and we were trying to get Bluetooth on phones. And this is we're going to jump into a bit of the tech behind it, but we're trying to get Bluetooth on phones to work reliably in the background and to exchange beacons. And there's a few different ways of doing that. So we were exploring and prototyping and building out test harnesses to see how this works and trying to figure out how do we handle the fact that different phones have different signal strengths. So you don't get this reliable signal between devices. So we're trying to figure out how do we do that. We were working with colleagues in Fraunhofer in Germany who'd done extensive calibration work, but it only ended up being on kind of the top 60 devices in Germany. So we're kind of bolting what they'd done in there We took the equivalent from Singapore and tried to bolt some of this stuff in as well. But it turns into a really hard engineering challenge, and you're really pushing that particular piece to the edge of what it can do. And you're trying to get phones to do something that they're not necessarily designed to do, because phones are designed to run reliably and give you the apps that you want to use on an ongoing basis. So if it sees something running in the background, the operating system itself has the right to go in and kill it. And we were trying to find ways to circumvent and get around that. And we were working with, ultimately the problems occurred in iOS primarily. There were issues in Android as well, but on the iOS side of it, you couldn't get this to work reliably in the background and to wake up. So basically what the Singapore guys had done was ask people to have the phone running in the background. So in low power mode, but running in the foreground all the time. But that's an inconvenience for people. And as soon as it goes into the background, it disappears. So we were working through all these, and it wasn't just us. So it was us. There was teams in Germany. There was teams all across Europe. There was teams in basically all across the world. Like, we were collaborating, and this weird global collaboration just kicked off. Within weeks of this starting, people were just talking to each other and exchanging stories, because we were all trying to solve the same problem. Mm. And if one of us won, we all won. And that was basically how it was treated. But I think ultimately where we ended up was we hit an impasse in that we couldn't get this to work reliably. And at the same time, Google and Apple, who are realistically, they were the only people who could actually come to the table and definitively say that we can make the changes in the operating system, or we can make a change at this level to create an infrastructure to allow everybody else to build on top of, and to do it in a way that preserves the privacy of their users. And then it became this set of trade-offs in terms of how they'd done it, what we wanted versus what we lost, and how we were trading off those things. And that was kind of that process as we went through it. But ultimately, when we did decide to go with the Google and Apple version of how this works, I think we ripped out about 10,000 lines of code. So wow. It's like it was a pretty significant undertaking.
And
tears shed.
Yeah, I can only imagine. On that though, at what stage did Nearform come into the process? Was this something that was kind of put out to tender, or how did that relationship develop?
So I guess it's one of those things that at the beginning of this process, that we were trying to find partners that we could work with on this, and it was at a very accelerated pace. So we had talked to a number of different companies, a number of different people had offered us, said we can do it, or we could do it for free. And I think one of the challenges with this is the time pressures that we're under, and making sure that we can deliver what we need to deliver. Free sounds amazing until it goes wrong, right? Mm-hmm. And that's one of the challenges with this. But that Nearform had popped up. We had been talking to a number of different companies about what we could do, but we needed somebody who could stand up quickly. And I think by the time, it was sometime around kind of middle or kind of end of March-ish, we were talking to Nearform. It was around the 23rd, I think, something like that. And Nearform, based on the first conversations that we had basically stood up a team. So this is like prior to it, developed a prototype, like a UX prototype of what the app would look like. And we're looking at and engaged kind of very, very experienced Bluetooth guys. And what we were looking for were people who had depth of experience in this area, because this is not, I mean, these are hard engineering challenges. So it's not like you can just pick any old organization, pick them up and do it. There's lots of people with amazing developers all across Ireland and companies all across Europe that we could have hit. But in terms of the experience Nearform had and the people that they had and the time frame for this, because Nearform, I think in like one of the things that they have kind of specialized in is these kind of insane projects. So the things that are running at an incredible pace where it's highly uncertain, it's ambiguous requirements, we're not entirely sure how it's going to work. And they're happy to work in that environment. Whereas if we were to go into a very structured requirements-based way of doing this, it wouldn't work. So it just you can't do it that way, not for something like this.
You mentioned about the Bluetooth beacons, which is something that I had the absolute pleasure and joy of trying to explain to people over the last number of months about this. Some people have expressed concern about, and you've said it yourself, about the accuracy of that. What can you say in that regard? You know, because I don't claim to know enough about it to be an authority on it, but my understanding is it's better than diddly squat.
Yeah, and that's basically it. Like, if you look at all the options, so the perfect way of doing this, so if you're to look at kind of what the gold standard for this would be to use ultra wideband. So in the latest greatest phones, so in the iPhone 11, the latest Samsung phones, you've got an ultra wideband chip. And that will give you centimeter base distance. So if this was 5 years in the future and we were doing this, that's how we do it. And but given that we don't have that, then you have to reduce this back into what do we have and what can we do with that. And what Bluetooth can give you is, you definitely know. So in terms of, and I think people become very, very obsessed with the accuracy thing to say it can't detect, is it exactly 2 meters? You have to remember that the 2 meters is a heuristic as well. So the 2 meters is part, like, it's a probability based determination of you're more likely at this level. But it won't say that if you're at 3 meters, you won't get infected, or if you're at 1 meter, you will get infected. Mm-hmm. It's saying on average. So when you begin to look at it that way, then we're looking overall at the at how accurate the results are. So are we picking up close contacts? Are we picking up people that we should pick up? And that's one of the pieces that we're working through at the moment. So we will be releasing data hopefully later on in this week. So I think that's prior to, before this weekend, we should be releasing something. And it's really to give people a sense of how this is working mm-hmm. and what's happening. So I can't give you much more than that at the moment.
That's all right. We'll come back to you.
In terms of the relationship with Apple and Google and using the Bluetooth technology and using the exposure notifications, were you and your team cautious going into the relationship between them? Because for many years, journalists like myself have been expressing concerns in relation to the level of information that big tech companies have on us. And now we were telling people to download this app and to enable things like the exposure notification. So just from your own side and from your own team's point of view, did you go in eyes wide open, or were you just grateful to have the assistance?
No, this was like originally when the conversations began, because like what happened when we went with Google and Apple, it had a couple of consequences. So one was we were going to have to rip out what we were doing, but the other was we moved. And if you remember back to April of this year, there was this whole debate raging about centralized, decentralized, is bad and decentralized is good. Right. So that was an ongoing bit. So as soon as we committed to going with Apple and Google, we were actually taking public health on a journey they'd never been on before. So when you move to a decentralized model, what you lose is any link between the index patients, that's the person who's tested positive, and the contact that they've had with anybody else. And if you talk to any public health doctor, so if you talk to Sarah Doyle in the HSC, who's the head of public health, like if you talk to her, the idea of not having a connection between the index patient and the contacts that they have, it's not something that's ever existed. You always have that, right? So you always have a person and then people they've been in contact with. And you may not know where the index patient got infected, but downstream from that, you will always know the connection. And the centralized model is basically built on that. So it's built with that in mind. When you move to the decentralized model, we had to take the public health guys on a journey to explain now what's possible with this, but also what's not possible with this. So we can't do hotspot analysis. We can't do this. We can't do that. So that was the first thing that happened on the back of it. And we had serious reservations as we were looking at this in the first place as to whether this would work or do enough for us in order to go down that road. I think on the privacy side of it, we had all of the same concerns. So we had to make sure that we were comfortable with how this would work. And I think the way Google and Apple had been looking at it, and it's nearly like a triple lock, in that they built it in such a way that they can't enable it, they can't turn it on, it's not there, so it's not theirs to use, but it's enabling infrastructure that can only be turned on by a public health authority, but they've got to authorize that we are a public health authority who can do that. And then the last piece is that a user has to then trust that this app does the job that it needs to do. So we were, and the design of this in terms of how it works is with this privacy preserving design at its core. Mm-hmm. So, and all throughout the app, so the whole design of it is designed to not know, or to know as little about anybody as possible. And the underlying infrastructure is basically waking up every few minutes, exchanging beacons, collecting beacons, saying, hey, I'm here, and sending an identifier, and then collecting any identifiers it picks up in range and it stores them. It doesn't do anything else, and it all stays local on the phone. And Apple and Google know nothing about that. The user on the phone doesn't have any access directly to it. We don't have any access to it. We only have access via Apple and Google. So we access that via an API that they provide us. And then when we pass in, so every couple of hours, you're downloading these the random IDs that have been uploaded by positive people down onto your phone, comparing them against what you've collected. And if you get a match, and that match matches the case definition, which is 2 meters, 15 minutes, which is again that whole process around that, then you'll get a notification to say you've been in close contact with somebody who's tested positive for COVID-19. But at that point, Apple and Google don't have any data to say who you are, where you are, what's happened. They know that APIs are working, but yeah, they're not tying it into anything else. So it was all done with that piece in mind. And it's, I think one of the interesting things for us was that as soon as we moved into that model, it addressed a lot of privacy concerns that have been raised about the previous design of the app in terms of what we were trying to do with it beforehand. And it seemed to satisfy people as to how that would work. So I think that's, and that was an ongoing process, and it's something that we've had. So we've been working closely with Science Foundation Ireland, who've put together various research groups to look at different aspects of this. So looking at privacy, looking at ethics, looking at user experience, looking at at the epidemiology side of it, looking at the Bluetooth and just how those bits work. And that's kind of all fed into this process as well. So it's, and again, to emphasize that it's not just us, because we're doing this, but also like we're working with our colleagues in Germany, in Switzerland, in Denmark, in Poland, in Italy, and globally now too. And we all have the same questions. We all have the same concerns. We all have to look after and make sure that we're treating our citizens' data with respect and to make sure that this does its job. And I think from an Apple and Google perspective, they're moving towards, because I think one of the challenges here is that we were moving so fast. Like when we committed to go with Google and Apple, the API wasn't ready yet. So we, on a Monday, we decided to do it, and we didn't get the like the developer SDK until the Wednesday. And then at that point, it's still, so you're building on top of something that's evolving. So it was moving very, very fast. And I think the, when it's moving at that speed, you're trying to figure out, well, how much can I tell people about what's going on inside? So the transparency question came up time and again. And one of the things from the outside in, you expect everybody to know everything. But for, in the inside, we were learning as fast as we could and going through that cycle. So when it gets, and now that things have stabilized, and so we're up and running, as are a bunch of other countries at this point. So everything is beginning to stabilize. And a lot of the work that Apple and Google are doing is really about transparency, how this works, showing people the code inside of it, making sure that everybody's comfortable with how this whole bit hangs together, and publishing more information around it. But at the time, it was either build the API or write the documentation about the API. It was one or the other. Like, because you can't do it all.
Yeah.
Inside that time frame.
Yeah. You're listening to Gar McCreesta, who was the project lead for the COVID tracker app. And Gar, one of the things that we've spoken quite a lot on this program about, and I interviewed Graham Doyle, who's the Deputy Commissioner at the Office of the Data Protection Commission. He, you know, concurred in that they looked very, very closely at the transparency on this app. And, you know, in my conversations with him, what I gathered is they do not care that I am Jess Kelly and my date of birth is whatever and I live in whatever. It's all about tracking the virus rather than tracking the person.
Exactly. Yeah. And that's, I think, one of the things that happened as part of this were that the calls for transparency were, it shaped a lot of the way we approach this project. So people talk about privacy by design, and that comes up and those terms get bandied around. This is probably the first thing where that's been the primary mode of design for something that I've ever worked on, right? In that nearly every decision went through that lens. So as we looked at every decision, we said, do we need this? So we looked at every single piece of data and said, do we need it? Why do we need it? How long do we need it for? What's it for? Can we justify this? And for each and every aspect of that. And then along with that, we were open sourcing the code base, and that was for a number of different reasons. So one was for transparency, because like if you can see, so, and it's not for everybody. So for non-developers, it makes no sense whatsoever. Mm-hmm. You're looking at a code base. And I remember we had some very funny conversations about, can you send me the code base? And I think people were expecting a Word document with the code in it. It was like, it doesn't work that way. Mm-hmm. So we had these kind of weird situations where people were demanding something they didn't understand. But we published the code base, and then that was reviewed, and people tore that apart to try and figure out what we were doing, and should we be doing this, and should we be doing that. And that's been great because it gives us feedback on that. We also published the data protection impact assessment, and that was it was like 2 to 3 weeks before we actually released. So everybody had plenty of time to pull this apart. And I think it's in a way, it's a rod for your own back, because we, like, I think generally the feedback on the data protection impact assessment is this is exactly what all projects in the public service should look like. And this is the kind of data protection impact assessment that should be created. And I think it's one of the challenges with things like this is that they're mostly technical documents in terms of technical from a like from a data protection perspective. So it's looking at the specific regulations.
It's very wordy. I read through it on the day that the app was released at about midnight on the Monday night, I think it was. I read through it and I've sat through more data protection briefings than anyone should ever have to sit through. And when I was reading through, I acknowledged some of the terminology. I still don't really know what it means, but it was all there. So it's there if you want to. And I appreciated that it was there. But a lot of it is kind of over the head of the general consumer.
It is. And I guess for people who know and for people who are in the business of this, they could tell that work had gone in like that. And that wasn't the last for it. I mean, I think that we had multiple iterations of this as we went through it, as we're trying to figure out what the, like, under what legal basis do we collect the data? So we collect it under consent, which is the weakest form, which gives the people using the app the most control. So you can withdraw consent. So you can say, good luck, I'm done, I'm out of here. And and that's exactly what we wanted. In other countries, it's been done under public health regulations, which gives it stronger. So it's got a stronger legal basis for the collection of the data, but it also changes the game. And we were looking at participation and the voluntary nature of this. So we wanted to be voluntary. We wanted to be consent-based. We wanted to get, and this has been framed as a collective action from, like, as part of the national response to COVID-19. It's not something that we're demanding people do. It's not something that we're telling people they have to do. Like, in some apps and some jurisdictions, if you've got the data, you're compelled legally to do it, and there are penalties if you don't. We don't have any of that. And again, the Irish population kind of turned this around and said, yes, we will participate. We'll jump on board, put the green jersey on and do it. And I think part of it was, and it goes to the overall, because this, again, it was, the scene was set at the very beginning with Tony Holohan, with the Minister of Health at the time, with Taoiseach at the time, that there was a very consistent narrative that ran through, and there was kind of a very high trust that we were building on top of this baseline. It was a very coherent strategy, and in terms of what the response looked like, I think at the time it was that we were also freaked out by it. But actually, as we reflect back on it, it was a very strong message coming all the way through. So when we were coming out on top of that, we were building on top of this foundation, and we've been talking to other countries who are either using our app as their app or planning to build one of these. And the point we keep reiterating is that you have to understand where you're starting. So if you've got low trust, and if it's an incoherent strategy, then, like, going with an app, you're not going to have the same, like, you could build the same app, release it, and you're not going to have the same result, because it's not the same starting point. Because this is really, it's like, it's a complex problem, and it's a complex systems piece where it's multiple different interplay of variables in that. So it's not just one thing.
Some of the questions that have come into techtalk@newstalk.com over the last little while relate to that trust point, because there are people who will just never download the app point blank, because there is an element of sort of lack of trust there, I suppose. And when people reference things like the public services card, for example, you can acknowledge that the public services card wasn't ideal, but this is something separate entirely. And if you download the app, it gives you the option to put your number in and all the rest, but you don't have to do it. So can you just reiterate and address that point? You know, there is no database that says Jess Kelly has this on her Pixel A4 phone and works in Dublin 2 and lives in Dublin 18. There's none of that going on.
No, there's none. I mean, you can download the app and you can onboard onto the app and provide no information. You can say, I don't want to share metrics, and you can say, I don't want to put a phone number in. And at that point, you're invisible to the HSC, but you're protected in that if you come into close contact with somebody who has tested positive, you will be notified. And that gives you, so we know absolutely nothing about you. And that creates a huge, so from an operational perspective, we kind of fly blind on a whole chunk of activity that's happening in the app, and that we can't say what happened or what didn't happen. If you choose to share metrics, they are literally just saying for certain things that have happened. So if you get a close contact event, we want to know. And because one of the questions that comes up to do with the, well, basically that, and it goes back to a question you asked earlier about how well does this work, but the efficacy of it. So unless we know that this is working, we can't tell if it's working at all. And we know in other countries that some of them are flying blind a little bit in terms of what's actually going on. So we wanted to be able to at least play that back. So if I put that in, we can tell that things are happening, but we don't know who and we don't know where. So we, like, literally it's a number, it's a counter that just goes plus one, plus two, one, plus one, plus one, and it just keeps adding it up. And then following on from that, so the reason for the phone number in the first place, so the previous app, like, and this is back to April, we were using a phone number, and when you onboarded, you put a phone number in, and we validated the phone number and sent you a one-time code. And it was really around making sure that we had a connection to you, that we could contact you if you had a close contact.
Mm-hmm.
And that was in the role of the HSE as a healthcare provider in Ireland. So looking after people who are paying taxes in Ireland who want care. When we got rid of that, we still recognized the fact that people were still like, there are people in at-risk age categories, there are the famous worried well, there are people who are have underlying health conditions that just want to be cared for. They want somebody to contact them.
Yeah.
So we gave the ability to put a phone number in there where if you did get a close contact notification, it would send a message to the contact tracing centers, who would then call you back and say, hi, Jess, how are you doing? I know you've had a close contact, and then help them through the process and support them through that.
Mm.
Because when people get notified, regardless, even in manual contact tracing, when you get a phone call from the HSE that says, we've identified you as a close contact of somebody who's tested positive, people freak out.
Yeah, you'd wet yourself. You absolutely would. You'd panic. There's no denying it.
Yeah.
It's a scary thing that we've all been told that we don't want to happen, but it does happen, unfortunately, and unfortunately the numbers are rising at the moment, so it's likely that the instances will increase. But just a quick point, because we're up against the clock now, but in relation to the notifications that people get, I know a few people, like last night, for example, I got a little pop-up, and it was basically my phone saying a weekly reminder that your exposure notifications are on, and it was just letting me click in and seeing any time that the app has looked and scanned to see if I've been in contact with anybody. What about when you get a notification saying that you have been in close contact with somebody? Is that panic stations, or is it just letting you know that somebody is being tested? I just think there's a bit of a confusion around that.
So Google and Apple have this status message that basically wakes up and it's once a week, and it tells people that this is running. And it's running in the background. And we've been talking to them, and they're changing the language in it as well, because that has caused probably more phone calls to HSE Live than any other thing.
Mm.
And it's there as a piece of feedback for users to say, this is on, this is running, and all is okay. But the information that it was providing wasn't helpful and was confusing people, and people thought they were getting close contact notifications. So if you get that summary message and it's got this little red icon that looks like a COVID icon in the corner, it's coming from Apple and Google. It's not coming from us. So if you're an Android, it'll look like a system notification, and on iOS, the same thing. So but the notification that comes from the app, if you've had a close contact event, it's an in-app notification that pops up, says it's from the COVID tracker. When you tap that, it opens it up. And in the app itself, there's a big red card that appears in there to say you have had a close contact event, and you've been in close contact with somebody who's tested positive for COVID-19. And then it gives you advice as to what to do. And there's two parts for that. So one is, and this is somebody, and I guess it's not somebody who may have it. This is somebody who has tested positive. They've tested positive. They've got the result. And as part of the phone call that they receive from the HSC for the result, they're asked if they're an app user, and they're asked, would you upload the random IDs from your phone? It's only at that point, when those random IDs are uploaded, a couple of hours after that, all the other phones in the network are downloading those and comparing them against what they've collected on their phone. And at that point, you get a notification, but it's only for people who've tested positive. It's not a speculative thing that they may or may not have. This is, you have a definitive, and this is part of the work we're now doing across Europe, is it's making sure that every health system that we're dealing with deals with this consistently, that it's a positive lab-based test, that it's not, I have some symptoms and I'm declaring myself to be. This is, I am positive for COVID-19. And when that key gets published, or that ID gets published, that we know it's associated with somebody who's definitely tested positive for COVID-19. It's not just a random piece of information or a guess that maybe I've got some symptoms. This is definitive. So when you get the notification, it means that you have had a close contact event with somebody who definitely has tested positive for COVID-19.
Okay, that's an important point to clarify, because I have seen people posting screenshots of the Apple or Google notification and putting that out there as like, the app is telling me that I may have been in contact with someone. And I think this is the first time that we've had something like this. It's a scary time. It's a global pandemic. So understandably, people are freaked out. But I do think it's important to note that it's when you have been in contact with a confirmed case, it'll come in via the app.
Yes, it'll come in via the app. And the way to confirm that is to open the app, and you will see this red card inside of it. And it's like on that screen with all the statistics.
Mm.
There's basically, it takes up half the screen, so you can't miss it. And it's big and it's red.
Okay.
And it's basically shouting at you to say, pay attention to this. This is something important. If you haven't got that, you haven't had a close contact event.
Okay.
That's the
That's the thing to watch out for. So just very quickly, some quick fire things. The Google Android battery drain issue, I'm sure, was a pain in the face. And I can only imagine you screaming into a pillow that weekend. Is that resolved? And do we know what went wrong?
So we do know what went wrong. And there was a couple of different parts to it. One was, so these identifiers have a fixed structure. And there was a malformed identifier. It didn't come from a phone. It was part of an operational readiness test. It was passed in. And it basically got bundled up on the Friday night, distributed out to phones. And what then happened was, when it got passed into the exposure notification system, it ended up getting itself into a loop. And that was, it was trying to retry matching this over and over and over again. Mm-hmm. And it just got stuck. And that required, and like Google were, and actually one of the guys who's involved in this was in the middle of an Ironman when he got a phone call. I kid you not, right? It's thanks, Jake. He's based over in California. So he came back from that to fix this. So, and this was like all, so we found out about it Saturday evening. By Sunday, about 7, we had a fix that was being pushed out, but it's a fix to Google Play services. So that rolls out, and that's, so phones get it incrementally over time. So it's not just one, and we can't just push it out. So it's not like an app update. And that both removed the issue and put a fix in so it wouldn't happen again. And then we made sure that it wouldn't happen again as well. So we've changed. So we made a number of different changes to our backend to make sure that this can't happen. So it's a bit paranoid now, and that we're checking in a lot of different places the same thing to make sure, is it the right size? Is it the right shape? Does it look right? And then we just go through that. So that was like, it was really because I was getting friends, family, like coworkers, everybody, it was just kicking off and burning up. And it was like, it's one of those things that when you're running at speed, things do happen, and software, as I've said often enough now, you pay for the software and the bugs come for free. Mm-hmm. And then you end up paying for the bugs. But I think we paid for the bugs in pain, sweat, tears, and lost weekends and lost sleep. But once we got the fix out there, I think that the way this was handled in terms of the turnaround time for something that required like this level of input, and Google were brilliant in this. And both Google and Apple actually they've been really great to work with. So we have direct access to the product teams, and we've got support both locally, like both at a European level, and then from the product teams based out of their headquarters. And they've been amazing all the way through. And I think it's one of the things that probably gets overlooked a lot, is that they look at like everybody talks to the teams who are actually building the apps. The guys there who are actually building this infrastructure are trying to support like tens of teams around the world who are all building apps in parallel, and they're finding and fixing all these problems. And this is an ongoing thing, and it's something that we're all learning as we go through. So we're trying to figure it out and trying to do it as best we can, but it is running very fast. I think we're getting to a point now where it is beginning to stabilize. And I can't definitively say there will not be any more bugs, but I think in terms of things like that, we're making sure, and we have trawled through to try and ensure that there's nothing in this code base that can create a situation that's going to cause something like that to happen again.
Have you recovered the numbers in terms of people who uninstalled the app over that weekend?
So we recovered a lot of the numbers that came back, and it's one of those things, because we don't, and because this is of the privacy preserving nature of this, we can't tell. So we can't tell who's gone, who's come back. So we can tell some things. So our net position as of the 13th was, I think we'd lost 83,000 people, something like that. And we'll be issuing some more metrics today. We're just going back and looking at that again. But it's a lot of people came back once they discovered that it was safe to come back. So there was generally, and even the sentiment in social media was that, I will come back as soon as it's safe. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't just I'm never coming back again. There's obviously people, and I can only apologize to the people who suffered from this, but we're doing our best to try and make sure and recover this, and trying to get it back to a point where, and to rebuild that trust if we've lost that trust. But I think where we are right now, I can't give you a definitive number today because we're literally looking at it this morning. So when we finish here, but we will be able to update on numbers later on this week. I expect we will definitely have lost some people, and it's regrettable, because I think if you initially took the step to download the app, it's terrible that we've lost you. So we'd love to get those people back, and we're trying to figure out ways that we can do that and rebuild that trust. But it is one of those things that there will definitely be people who went, nope, That's it for me. Mm-hmm. So I think the only thing I can say is that that problem is resolved. It's not going to hurt your battery. And I think from a battery consumption perspective, so overall, the app doesn't really have any impact on how your phone performs. It's just sitting there quietly in the background doing its job. And that was one of the things that we did with moving to the Apple and Google solution for this, was that we got the benefit of them being able to manage all of that stuff. So they look after the phones. Yeah. They look after and make sure that if it was us and we were building our own one on top, we'd be goosed totally. Mm-hmm. We wouldn't be able to handle this.
Yeah, for the people who did uninstall the app, you know, this is something that I've been saying for quite a while, and it's not like it's a personal opinion in that, you know, I'm not a scientist, I'm not a doctor, I can't do anything other than wash my hands, wear a mask and have the app on my phone. That's the extent of my ability to help fight COVID-19. And if you did uninstall the app, or if you haven't downloaded it yet, it's not too late, and we're seeing those numbers and we're seeing the graph increase, and it's a scary time. So, you know, please do consider putting it on your phone. And, you know, if issues like this do arise again, like, we're getting the vibe that it's going to be resolved within a shorter time frame as possible. Gar, I've kept you for way too long now, but my final question is, having seen the success and the turnaround time of this, and, you know, fingers crossed that we never run into another pandemic where we need to turn around something as quickly as this, do you think that there are learnings from the HSE, which I know already embraces digital in a number of different ways, but do you think that the learning curve of this can be embraced and replicated on future projects?
Yes, I do. I don't think anybody wants to work at the pace we were working at, because I think anybody who was involved in this at all, and we were kind of, I mean, we were happily sitting in home offices working away, and that's fine. Like, we weren't on the front line of this. So we had, it was hard work and long hours, but it's nothing in comparison to what the frontline workers were doing on this. So that, I think that's the first thing to clarify on it. But in terms of the learnings from it, I mean, this is, like, if you look at how the cooperation worked, because we had a number of companies. So Nearform were doing the development work, Explio were doing the testing work, we had ISAS, we had EdgeScan looking at the security side of it. We had teams set up from Science Foundation Ireland looking at it. So we had researchers who were working with us on this. And it was a multi-agency thing. So it was the HSE, the Department of Health, Department of Public Expenditure, and Garda Síochána and Defence Forces. And so this was a cross-governmental collaboration. And these things usually take time in the first place to set up. And in the normal course of events, I think we've all accepted that this probably wouldn't get off the ground if there was no pressure or urgency on it. I think the pressure and the urgency, that creates the space for something like this to happen. But there's definitely, like, that ability to partner both with the academic community, but also with private sector industry, to kind of try and solve these problems quickly and to bring the best and the brightest. And, like, this was... like, nearly everybody involved in this was Irish based. So this is like an Irish success story. It's not the HSE, it's not the HSE and Department of Health. This is an Irish success story. So you've got Nearform, who've gone on building the app in Northern Ireland, building the app in Scotland, Pennsylvania and Delaware and elsewhere. So we've got this burgeoning success. It also brought in, so we've open sourced this now and pushed it into the Linux Foundation. So it's called COVID Green and the Linux Foundation, and other countries are picking it up. Nearform have nothing to do with that, but we're kind of spreading our reach. So this is a massive success from an Ireland perspective. We're the first country who's turned on interoperability between two jurisdictions. So us in Northern Ireland, when we turned that on a couple of weeks ago, that was the first time that you can now move from Ireland, travel up to Northern Ireland. When you meet somebody who's using the Stop COVID NI app, you're exchanging keys there, and when you come back down, and then we'll be doing that both kind of, it'll happen across Europe over the next couple of months. So by mid-September, we should have an infrastructure in place that goes to a European level. And this is all about enabling things to open up. So I think the partnership and that social partnership between the various parties involved, so between the academic community, between the public service organizations, and between private industry, I think that's going to be a critical success factor in terms of how we go about solving some of these problems again. And it was, if I go back to the beginning, I think that the key to this was not on focusing on the problem. It was all about focusing on the problem. So mm-hmm. we weren't coming up with just crazy solutions. It was focus on the problem. And I think you've interviewed Tim Willoughby before, and he says all the time, love the problem, not the solution, love the problem. So we spent all of our time and efforts on making sure that we understood what problem we were trying to solve. And then the solutions and options emerge. But if you go down the other way, and a lot of times we just end up falling into solutions, trying to retrofit them onto problems. This is, let's really figure out what the problems are we're trying to solve, and then find the parties who can help us solve those problems. And it doesn't matter where they come from. So I think there's huge learnings from this. I think the problem is it's trying to replicate the urgency of a situation like it is the difficulty with it, because everybody lines up. I mean, you didn't have to ask anybody to put the hours in or do anything like that. The purpose came for free in this. So everybody felt like they were actually contributing to it. Because I think at the time, back in March, April, there was a general powerlessness that people didn't feel like they had any control of the situation. So anybody who was working on this and anybody who's working on it in general are like have a very clear feeling that they're actually contributing to try and help like this national fight against COVID-19.
Well, look, I'm speaking for everyone now, but we do appreciate the effort that went into the development of this app. And again, like as you said, to Google and to Apple and to Nearform and to yourselves at the HSC, it is a fantastic achievement, and it's sort of the first of its kind. And hopefully people will download it, keep it on their phones, put it on the phone and almost forget about it. That will be the goal until you're needed to take action, I suppose, is the best way to think about it, right?
Yeah, and we've got a release coming out this week. And I think one of the major pieces of feedback that's come back is people were really interested in the data, mm-hmm. but they wanted that data to be more timely. So what we're doing, so in the release that's coming out this week, it's going to have what happened yesterday. And so the timeliness of the data as it arrives in, so we're pulling everything from GeoHive, which is the Department of Health's data hub. So we pull it in. So whatever becomes available there. So some of the data at a county level is a couple of days ago, mm-hmm. by the time it gets processed and goes through. But we're giving what is the live published information. So whatever is up there on GeoHive, we're publishing into the app. So it'll tell you what happened in your county. It'll tell you what happened the previous day, in some cases, like at a national level and a couple of days ago in your county. So you can see that trend line. And I think that's now that we're seeing the increase in cases, I think people are really, it's back to where we were in April, where we were fixated with the numbers and trying to figure out what's going on. So we're trying to help with that and give people what they're looking for. And I think we're going to have other pieces that we, like the roadmap for this, it's not like it is bounded by its response to the pandemic, but we're trying to give and listen to what people are asking for and then just give that back to them. So we're going to have other language versions coming out as well, which is another one that we've been very conscious of. We have Irish and English, but we're now going to have, we'll have Portuguese. In this version, we'll have Portuguese, then Latvian, Lithuanian, Polish and French. Brilliant. Coming soon, and then other languages coming then after.
Fantastic.
So we're,
stuff.
Well, again, look, we're just working through all of that.
Well, look, thank you so much for your time. I've kept you for almost an hour, so I do appreciate it. That is Garma Christa, who was a project lead on the COVID tracker app for the HSC. Thank you for joining us here on News Talk.
Thanks a million, Jess.
And there you have it. That is my very in-depth conversation with Garma Christa, the product manager for the COVID tracker app at the HSC. Garth, thank you for your time. I kind of kept him, initially it was meant to be a 15-minute piece and I kept him for 40 minutes. And I do appreciate being given that access and being given that time to talk through the different issues relating to the app. And as always, if you do have any questions, email techtalk@newstalk.com.